Come, spellweavers, reavers, rogues, and men-at-arms, and answer the call of adventure. Pick up your sword, your axe, your spellbook, your bow, your rulebook, and your dice, and join the forces of good in their eternal fight against vile monsters, conspiring min-maxers, horny bards, and blood-soaked murder hobos. Discover the treasure trove of role-playing games here on Rollin' Bones. My name is Ryan Howard, and I shall be your guide.
Good evening, boneheads, and welcome back to Rollin' Bones with Ryan Howard, where we make old school young again. I'm your host and king of the boneheads, Ryan Howard, and tonight's going to be a lot different than what we normally do. I don't have a guest. It's just going to be me. Haven't done that in forever. It's been, God, probably a couple years. And we are going to be reading through as much of the White Box, the original three D&D books, as we can get through in my allotted time. I have no idea how far we're going to get into it, and if we don't finish it tonight, which we probably won't, then I will do the rest of it at a future date. But that's what we're going to do tonight in honor of the 50th anniversary of its release. We are going to be looking at the White Box and just kind of going paragraph by paragraph, seeing what's changed, what stayed the same. Just really taking a good hard look at the original release of D&D. Before we do that, though, I want to remind everyone to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you see here on Rollin' Bones. That's the best way to give us a little bump in the algorithm and let people know that we're out here doing all this stuff. And you can find me on various social media platforms. On X and Instagram, I am at Howard_RyanGreg. YouTube is Rollin' Bones. Twitch is twitch.tv/RollinBonesRyan. And Substack is RollinBones.substack.com. I actually did an article on Substack that I'm going to talk about for just a little bit at the beginning of the show. So you can read that in its entirety over on my Substack. I will drop the link here in chat. And also want to remind everyone that you can get Rollin' Bones merch over on TeePublic. We got a couple designs over there. I will go ahead and drop the link to that over here in chat. You can also find these links in the pinned comment if you are watching this after the fact. And last but not least, want to remind everyone that you can still get my adventure, O Night Divine, on DriveThruRPG. It will be available there until, well, pretty much forever, until DriveThruRPG ceases to exist. You'll be able to get O Night Divine on there. So you can find that link here in chat or in the pinned comment. So that is it for my shilling to start the episode. I do want to talk a little bit about this article that I wrote on my Substack, which is, I called it Ampersand Anniversary. I'll go ahead and share the tab so that you guys can see it here. And this is just an article where I talk a little bit about D&D, but mostly it's my thoughts on these kind of corporate milestone anniversaries and how they're trotted out and celebrated for these big franchises. You know, we're not that far away. You know, just a couple years from what will be the 50th anniversary of Star Wars. And I can imagine Disney is going to do it up even bigger than what Hasbro did here with D&D. Honestly, I haven't seen a whole lot for D&D's 50th anniversary so far. I know, you know, they're rolling out 5.5 or 6e or whatever we're supposed to call one D&D now. But still, there's this weird thing about these anniversaries because, yes, a product with the name Dungeons and Dragons has been continuously available for 50 years. However, the weird thing about it is the Dungeons and Dragons that you can buy on store shelves today is a completely different animal from the Dungeons and Dragons that was released 50 years ago. And that's been the case since, I mean, you know, some people like Jeffro would say 1980. I will not put the death date of D&D at 1980. I'm going to say 2000, though, because it's in 2000 when Wizards of the Coast buys TSR. And at that point, everything that's released loses its direct lineage back to Gygax. Now, yeah, Monty Cook and, you know, some of the guys that worked on third edition did work on older editions. But even second edition, which had basically no Gygax involvement at all, was largely spearheaded by Zeb Cook, who did work with Gygax. And the designers that were on staff during that time worked with Gygax and knew Gygax, and, you know, really second edition kind of carries over a lot of first edition AD&D. I don't like what they did with it, but you can still see the lineage. You can see the direct line. You can no longer draw that lineage after 2000. And it's the same thing with Star Wars. You no longer have the lineage back to Lucas following the Disney acquisition. And so you have these weird IPs where, yes, they technically still exist, but it's really nothing more than a name. You're slapping a name on something. And so there's something weird and really kind of anti-creative about just continuing to marionette the corpse of an IP just because it's a name that someone recognizes. And so that's what this article is all about. But that's beside the point. I know you guys are here for White Box. So instead of wallowing in my misery about how intellectual property is treated in this day and age, let's take a look at the White Box. So, moving on over here. For those of you who don't know, the White Box refers to the original Dungeons & Dragons release. This was the cover. It is called the White Box because it was a white box. Now, the original D&D release, I believe, came in like a weird wooden box with different color books. This was kind of the first mass market release of Dungeons & Dragons, but these are your original rules. This is, you know, when people were first playing D&D, this is what they were playing. These are the rules that they were playing with. And as you'll see as we go through this, you know, this game was designed to be played with wargaming rules, specifically chainmail. Again, for those of you who don't know, chainmail was wargaming with fantasy elements added into it. And so that's where Dungeons & Dragons kind of draws its direct lineage from, is this game Chainmail, which is mentioned in the credits of this book as one of the essential things that you need to run the game. However, this is what we start with. And as you can see here, both Gygax and Arneson's name are on it. This will be pretty much the only time that happens. And you've got three books here: Men and Magic, Monsters and Treasure, The Underworld and Wilderness Adventures. And that's what makes up the original core books of Dungeons and Dragons. So let's scroll on down here. We see our first cover, this kind of brownish cover here with a fighter right on the cover, letting you know what you're in for. I've just now kind of noticed this, but when you see this fighter, kind of the way his helmet looks and the way, especially that mustache, you can see where Sturm Brightblade came from design-wise when you look at the warrior here on the cover of Men and Magic. I just now realized that. And maybe I'm definitely late to the party on that one, but just something to point out there. And we go past the index, and I'm going to start here with the foreword. So I'm going to zoom in a little bit. Once upon a time, long, long ago, there was a little group known as the Castle and Crusade Society. Their fantasy rules were published and, to this writer's knowledge, brought about much of the current interest in fantasy wargaming. For a time, the group grew and prospered, and Dave Arneson decided to begin a medieval fantasy campaign game for his active Twin Cities Club. From the map of the land, end quote, of the, quote, Great Kingdom, end quote, and environs the territory of CNC Society, Dave located a nice bog wherein to nest the weird enclave of Blackmoor, a spot between the Great Kingdom and the fearsome Egg of Coot. From the chainmail fantasy rules, he drew ideas for a far more complex and exciting game and thus began a campaign which still thrives as of this writing. In due course, the news reached my ears, and the result is what you have in your hands at this moment. While the CNC Society is no longer, its spirit lives on, and we believe that all wargamers who are interested in the medieval period, not just fantasy buffs, will enjoy playing Dungeons & Dragons. Its possibilities go far beyond any previous offering anywhere. While it is possible to play a single game unrelated to any other game events, past or future, it is the campaign for which these rules are designed. It is relatively simple to set up a fantasy campaign, and better still, it will cost almost nothing. In fact, you will not even need miniature figurines, although their occasional employment is recommended for real spectacle when battles are fought. A quick glance at the equipment section of this booklet will reveal just how little is required. The most extensive requirement is time. The campaign referee will have to have sufficient time to meet the demands of his players, and he will have to devote a number of hours to laying out the maps of his dungeon and upper terrain before the affair begins. The third booklet of this set will be of great help in this respect, for a number of helpful suggestions regarding how to accomplish it all have been given in order to help you accomplish the task with a minimum of time and effort. There should be no want of players, for there is unquestionably a fascination in this fantasy game, evidenced even by those who could not, by any stretch of the imagination, be termed ardent wargamers. The longevity of existing campaigns, notably Blackmoor in the Twin Cities and Greyhawk in Lake Geneva, and the demand for these rules from people outside these campaigns point towards a fantastic future. The Tactical Studies Rules believes that of all forms of wargaming, fantasy will soon become the major contender for first place. The section of this booklet entitled Scope will provide an idea of just how many possibilities are inherent in Dungeons and Dragons. These rules are strictly fantasy. Those wargamers who lack imagination, those who don't care for Burroughs' Martian adventures where John Carter is groping through the black pits, who feel no thrill upon reading Howard's Conan saga, who do not enjoy the DeCamp and Pratt fantasies, or Fritz Leiber's Fofford and the Grey Mouser, pitting their swords against evil sorcerers, will not be likely to find Dungeons & Dragons to their taste. But those whose imagination knows no bounds will find that these rules are the answer to their prayers. With this last bit of advice, we invite you to read on and enjoy a world where the fantastic is fact and magic really works. Excuse me. E. Gary Gygax, Tactical Studies Rules Editor, November 1st, 1973, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. All right. Yeah. So there we get the mission statement of what D&D is, just, you know, from the get-go. Obviously, you know, people may not realize this, but if you've watched Secrets of Blackmoor, you know this idea of fantasy role-playing wasn't actually invented by Gygax, but it was really innovated by Gygax. That Castle and Crusade Society that Gygax mentions, they're the ones who kind of created this, and then Arneson kind of ran with it in his direction. But it was really Gary's role was taking these rules, refining them, and delivering them in a consumable package. And that's not to say that Gary Gygax didn't do anything meaningful, because he absolutely did. People really underrate the ability to make something coherent, especially to people who are not like experts. And that's the strength of what Gygax did. Now, a lot of people look at these rules now and say, well, I don't understand what's going on here. That's because we live in a different world than the world that Gygax lives in. He had certain expectations of his readers, and that's why a lot of people can't parse through the High Gygaxian, as a lot of people like to call it. But what Gygax was doing here was taking these ideas, these disparate threads of ideas, bringing them together and making them into a coherent, usable product. And for that alone, we should still be celebrating Gygax the way that really anyone with any intelligence or integrity does. The people who say that Gygax didn't do anything are morons. I'll, you know, put it that way. Crossface, hot take, 3LBB is the best edition of D&D. I mean, there's certainly an argument to be made there. I still like AD&D. That's my favorite edition, but, you know, AD&D first edition, but, you know, these rules are great. They still hold up. You can still play a great campaign with these rules, especially if you're using chainmail, and especially if you're scaling your campaigns up to the wargame level using the chainmail rules. So with that, let's move on to this introduction here. These rules are These rules are as complete as possible within the limitations imposed by the space of three booklets. That is, they cover the major aspects of fantasy campaigns, but still remain flexible. As with any other set of miniature rules, they are guidelines to follow in designing your own fantastic medieval campaigns. They provide the framework around which you will build a game of simplicity or tremendous complexity. Your time and imagination are about the only limiting factors, and the fact that you have purchased these rules tends to indicate that there is no lack of imagination. The fascination of the game will tend to make participants find more and more time. We advise, however, that a campaign be begun slowly, following the steps outlined herein, so as to avoid becoming too bogged down with unfamiliar details at first. That way, your campaign will build naturally at the pace best suited to the referee and the players, smoothing the way for all concerned. New details can be added and old laws altered so as to provide continually new and different situations. In addition, the players themselves will interact in such a way as to make the campaign variable and unique. And this is quite desirable. Sorry. If you are a player purchasing the Dungeons & Dragons rules in order to improve your situation in an existing campaign, you will find that there is a great advantage in knowing what is herein. If your referee has made changes in the rules and/or tables, simply note them in pencil. For who knows when some flux of rules and/or who knows when some flux of the cosmos will make things shift once again, and keep the rules nearby as you play. A quick check of some rules or tables may bring hidden treasure to save your game life. All right. So I'm going to pause there again just for a little bit because I get the sense that some people read this and begin to see the foundations of Rule Zero. And this is something that a lot of us have been talking about recently. While Gary is kind of giving you permission to expand upon the rules, to, you know, play around with the tools that he gives you, this is not the Rule Zero that a lot of people cling to as religious dogma today. This isn't Gary saying none of this matters. This is Gary saying here is a structure to work with. Here's a foundation. You can build, you know, straight up, you can build a tower on this foundation, or you can build out, you can expand, you can do all kinds of crazy things with this foundation, but you still need the framework that is being established here. So just a little point of order there as we continue on in our reading. Men and Magic, Volume 1, details what characters can be played, potentials, limitations, and various magical spells. Monsters and Treasure, Volume 2, describes the beasts and creatures which will be encountered, as well as the kind and amount of treasure they are likely to guard, including magic items. Finally, The Underworld and Wilderness Adventures, Volume 3, tells how to set up and actually play the campaign. It is presented last in order to allow the reader to gain the perspective necessary, the understanding of the two preceding booklets. Read through the entire work in the order presented before you attempt to play. So, the order of these is not arbitrary. The order actually matters. Again, a lot of people, when they talk about this game, will mention that Gygax's rules are all over the place. That, again, is an erroneous assumption. Gygax organized these things in a very specific manner. You just have to read them to understand that. And Dundermoose here in chat makes a good point. Gary assumed he was talking to DMs on his level, and few were. So yeah, that's a shortcoming of Gary's. They say that, you know, true mastery is being able to explain complex ideas in a simple manner. There's certainly some truth to that. And I'm not saying that like Gary was a midwit or something like that, but I think Gary encountered a lot of people who were very similar to him. They read a lot of the same books as him. They had the same education level that he did. And I think he, you know, assumed that this would be the median gamer. I don't know if he thought of himself as extraordinary. I'm pretty sure he thought of himself as the average gamer. So I think at his level, you know, he thought that he was speaking to the average gamer. So, you know, at this point, though, I don't know. I can't talk to Gary and verify that. Let's put it that way. So from there, we move on to scope. Within the various equipage listed in the following sections, Dungeons & Dragons will provide a basically complete, nearly endless campaign of all levels of fantastic medieval war game play. Actually, the scope need not be restricted to the medieval. It can stretch from the prehistoric to the imagined future, but such expansion is recommended only at such time as the possibilities in the medieval aspect have been thoroughly explored. The use of paper, pencil, and map boards are standard. Miniature figures can be added if the players have them available and so desire, but miniatures are not required, only aesthetically pleasing. Similarly, unit counters can be employed, with or without figures. Although, by themselves, the bits of cardboard lack the eye appeal of the varied and brightly painted miniature figures. Age level is 12 years and up. At least one referee and from 4 to 50 players can be handled in any single campaign, but the referee-to-player ratio should be about 1 to 20 or thereabouts. So, this is something that you see the bros kind of talk about a lot. This game was really designed to be played by larger groups than people actually, you know, play in now. And yeah, the idea was basically for every 20 players, you had one game master. So once you get up to about the 50 player range, you're looking at a split group with two referees at that point, which, you know, makes sense. That it's a lot for, I think even Gary realized it's a lot for one dungeon master to handle. So at some point you need to kind of divvy up that workload. And he seemed to believe that it was about, you know, 20 players was about the max that one game master could handle. I also find it interesting that he lists it as 12 years and up, which means he believed that a 12-year-old could read and comprehend these rules and run the game correctly. So keep that in mind as we're going through this. Gary put that in there believing that a 12-year-old could read, comprehend, and run these rules. And I didn't grow up in the 70s, so I don't know. I've asked my dad about this before, but my dad grew up in rural North Carolina in a textile town. So, you know, he doesn't really have the best grasp on what like your average fantasy obsessed 12-year-old was capable of in 1974. We'll put it that way. But yeah, it doesn't seem out of the realm of possibility that your average 12-year-old in 1974 might have been able to actually handle this. And Jonathan Frost here actually does give us a little bit of insight. Having grown up with First Ed and played Second, AD&D Second, Third, Fourth, and Fifth, I can confidently say gamers used to be smarter on average. I'm less savvy and less on top of my stuff as I get older. I think we all kind of find ourselves in that situation. You have a lot more time to focus on stuff like this when you're younger, especially, and maybe that's why 12 is kind of your minimum age here, because at that age, you really are kind of at the peak of your ability to hyper-focus on something like this, get a bunch of friends together to hyper-focus on stuff like this and play. When I was 12, 13, 14 years old, that was the peak of my going over to friends' house and playing Halo until ungodly hours of the morning. So in 1974, this, for a lot of those kids would have been their equivalent. So that's a good point to bring up there, Jonathan. Now, recommended equipment. This is interesting, especially for the things that are listed and the things that aren't. So Dungeons and Dragons, which in parentheses here, you have it. Dice, you need the following. One pair of four-sided dice, one pair of eight-sided dice, 4 to 20 pairs of six-sided dice, one pair 20-sided dice, and one pair 12-sided dice. So we do have our polyhedrals present in this edition. I know a lot of gamers very early on used D6s, and I think maybe it's basic. It might be Holmes Basic that uses just D6s, but I might be misremembering that. Now, it also recommends you have 1 3-ring notebook, referee, and each player, graph paper, 6 lines per inch is best, sheet protectors, 3-ring lined paper, drafting equipment and colored pencils, scratch paper and pencils, imagination, 1 patient referee, and players. Now, you will notice miniatures actually aren't listed on here. Because as Gary mentioned earlier, miniatures are nice, they're cool, but they're not strictly necessary. Gary was assuming that most gamers were probably going to run this Theater of the Mind, and definitely encouraged players to run it Theater of the Mind. Blaine Crichton here in chat asks a good question. The other aspect would be the assumption of a club that includes 12-year-olds that would learn from older members. Yeah, I think 12 is kind of a reasonable age to be included in a group that, a group that had players who were 14, 15, 16, maybe even, someone's dad who was a Grognard wargamer would, be included in that group or something like that. But yeah, I think that's a good thing to call out there, is that a 12-year-old would be a part of a group with older players who would be able to help them kind of learn things as they go. And then Dundermoose points out that the original D20s had 1 through 10 listed twice, and so you had to color one side, which is interesting. And of course, Crossface points out that recommended means required. You're not going to be able to get away with not having dice, shall we say. Now, what's interesting in its omission here is also wilderness survival. Because, and this is apocryphal, but my understanding of D&D in this era was that all wilderness exploration was actually done with the wilderness survival game. At least that's what I've been led to believe by gamers who were playing in that era. It's not actually listed here as a recommended or required product. So I guess it was just kind of what Gary and his group did, or, you know, what most gamers did. And maybe it's not listed because it's an Avalon Hill product and this is not published by Avalon Hill. So that might be the reason. But oddly enough, even though kind of folk wisdom was that wilderness survival was also necessary along with chainmail, it's not actually listed in the book as a recommended resource for you. And now we get to preparation for the campaign. The referee bears the entire burden here, but if care and thought are used, the reward will more than repay him. First, the referee must draw out a minimum of half a dozen maps of the levels of his underworld, or dungeon. People them with monsters of various horrid aspects, distribute treasures accordingly, and note the location of the latter two on keys, each corresponding to the appropriate level. This operation will be more fully described in the third volume of these rules. When this task is completed, the participants can then be allowed to make their first descent into the dungeons beneath the huge ruined pile of vast castle built by generations of mad wizards and insane geniuses. Before they begin, players must decide what role they will play in the campaign, human or otherwise, fighter, cleric, or magic user. Thereafter, they will work upwards, if they survive, as they gain experience. First, however, it is necessary to describe fully the roles possible. So, before we get into classes and our understanding of these classes at this early stage, Gary is basically telling you all you need is a dungeon. And he is expecting that you will have at least 6 levels of this dungeon. So, I mean, you're looking at kind of a sizable dungeon to start with. And just to address some of the questions in chat here, Likely Arrow says, I know you know this, but there's an argument recently over whether chainmail is needed for D&D, and the other side said it was only recommended. Yeah, when you read through this book, which hopefully we'll get this far tonight, but you do need chainmail to actually make this work. Chainmail, one, helps you scale, but two, really helps you understand the combat system that Gary was working within. And without chainmail, you really can't use this game. And so I think a lot of the people who look at White Box and say, well, this is unplayable, forget that, yeah, even though chainmail is recommended, you need it. Like, maybe Gary should have made recommended stronger. Maybe he should have said essentials and put chainmail under essentials. But yeah, you do actually need chainmail. And Arnman says, very little wilderness play, but it was basically a hex crawl. The hex crawl was actually invented by wilderness survival or outdoor survival. And Crossface points out outdoor survival is not necessary for dungeon crawling. But the idea of the hex crawl comes from outdoor survival. So if you know, going by these rules, if you weren't fully playing out wilderness exploration, you wouldn't necessarily need outdoor survival. But if you're not doing that, which, you know, I think Gary would argue that you should do that. You would need something like Outdoor Survival, at least the hex map that came with it, because that was really the, I think, the only example of a hex map that a lot of these guys had. And that's why so many people use the Outdoor Survival map as kind of the de facto hex map for D&D exploration when they run white box games. Now, moving on to characters, we have three classes. Not four, three. And this is the WTF. Actually, no, not WTF. That's actually incorrect. It's fighting men, magic users, and clerics. There's no thief. Thief doesn't come until Greyhawk. So fighting men includes the characters of elves and dwarves and even halflings. Magic users include only men and elves. Clerics are limited to men only. All non-human players are restricted in some aspects and glorified in and gifted in others. This will be dealt with in the paragraphs pertaining to each non-human type. So, fighter, cleric, wizard. That's what you got. Those are your choices. And so, fighting men. All magical weaponry is usable by fighters, and this in itself is a big advantage. In addition, they gain the advantage of more hit dice, the score of which determines how many points of damage can be taken before a character is killed. They can use only a very limited number of magic items of the non-weaponry variety, however, and they can use no spells. Top-level fighters, lords and above, who build castles are considered barons, and as such, they may invest in their holdings in order to increase their income. See Investment Section, Volume 3. Base income for a baron is a tax rate of 10 gold pieces per inhabitant of the barony per game year. Guys, give me 1 second, and I will be right back. All right, we are back. So, magic users. Top-level magic users are perhaps the most powerful characters in the game, but it is a long, hard road to the top, and to begin with, they are weak. So survival is often the question, unless fighters protect the low-level magic types until they have worked up. The whole plethora of enchanted items lies in the magic user's beck and call, save the arms and armor of the fighters. See, however, elves. Magic users may arm themselves with daggers only. Wizards and above may manufacture for their own use or for sale such items as potions, scrolls, and just about anything else magical. Costs are commensurate with the value of the item, as is the amount of game time required to enchant it. And so here you've got some examples of item costs. So spell scrolls, 100 gold pieces per spell per level per week. So a fifth level spell would require 500 gold pieces in 5 weeks. Potion of healing, 250 gold pieces and 1 week. Potion of giant strength, 1,000 gold pieces plus 4 weeks. Enchanting 20 arrows, 1,000 gold pieces plus 4 weeks. Enchanting armor to plus 1, 2,000 gold pieces and 2 months. Wand of cold, 10,000 gold pieces and 6 months. X-ray vision ring, 50,000 gold pieces and 1 year. So your X-ray vision ring is going to end up being basically your grad thesis as a wizard. You're going to be working on that damn thing for a whole ass year. And from there, we go to clerics. Clerics gain some of the advantages from both the other two classes, fighting men and magic users, in that they have the use of magical armor and all non-edged magic weapons, no arrows. Plus, they have numbers of their own spells. In addition, they are able to use more of the magical items than are the fighting men. When clerics reach the top level, Patriarch, they may opt to build their own stronghold, and when doing so, receive help from above. Thus, if they spend 100,000 gold pieces in castle construction, they may build a fortress of double that cost. Finally, faithful men will come to such a castle, being fanatically loyal, and they will serve at no cost. There will be from 10 to 60 heavy cavalry, 10 to 60 horsed crossbowmen, the Tercopil type, and 30 to 180 heavy foot. Note that clerics of 7th level and greater are either law or chaos, and there is a sharp distinction between them. If a patriarch receiving the above benefits changes sides, all the benefits will immediately be removed. Clerics with castles of their own will have control of a territory similar to a barony of the fighters, and they will receive tithes equal to 20 gold pieces per inhabitant per year. Okay. Interestingly, clerics here are treated a lot more like paladins than you would expect. They can't use edge weapons, obviously, but there is this aspect. It's not just them building a temple. They're building a kingdom. So Gygax looked at clerics and basically thought that they would eventually become theocrats, which is interesting. Most people don't think about clerics in that way, but clearly that's how Gygax wanted us to think about clerics, was that eventually you would, you know, lead a nation as kind of a philosopher king or a high priest king, basically Moses. Only you'd have an actual physical fortress, not just a tabernacle that you brought with you everywhere. And now dwarves. Dwarves may opt only for the fighting class, and they may never progress beyond 6th level, Myrmidon. Their advantages are, 1, they have high levels of magic resistance, and they thus add 4 levels when rolling saving throws. A 6th level dwarf equals a 10th level human. They are the only characters able to fully employ the +3 magic warhammer explained in Volume 2. 3, they note slanting passages, traps, shifting walls, and new constructions in underground settings. And 4, they are able to speak the languages of gnomes, kobolds, and goblins in addition to the usual tongues. So yeah, dwarves here are experts in the underground. They add 4 levels when they roll their saving throws, which, I mean, damn, that's an advantage. Gygax clearly saw dwarves as hardy, especially in the saving throws department. But they could only reach 6th level. And then here you have the mention of the +3 magic warhammer. This is the earliest example of the dwarven thrower that we see. And then elves. Elves can begin as either fighting men or magic users and freely switch class whenever they choose, from adventure to adventure, but not during the course of a single game. Thus, they gain the benefits of both classes and may use both weaponry and spells. They may use magic, armor, and still act as magic users. However, they may not progress beyond 4th level fighting man, hero, nor 8th level magic user, warlock. Elves are more able to note secret and hidden doors. They also gain the advantages noted in chainmail rules when fighting certain fantastic creatures. Finally, elves are able to speak the languages of orcs, hobgoblins, and gnolls, in addition to their own elvish and the other usual tongues. So yeah, right here. If you don't have those chainmail rules, you don't know what advantages the elf gets. So yeah, buy the chainmail book too. Child in 1974. honestly, like the amount of times that chainmail is just referenced in this page alone tells you, yeah, you need those rules. Now, halflings. Should any player wish to be one, he will be limited to the fighting man class as a halfling. Halflings cannot progress beyond the fourth level, hero, but they will have magic resistance equal to dwarves, add four levels for saving throws, and they will have deadly accuracy with missiles as detailed in chainmail. So yeah, the idea here is, you know, with these non-human classes, basically a human in the world of D&D would dedicate themselves to adventuring for a lifetime, whereas Gygax views dwarves, elves, and halflings as, you know, they might have a little bit of an adventurous phase, but at a certain point, they're going to tap out sooner than humans will. And, you know, with some of these saving throw rules, you can see why that is, just from a balance perspective, because, you know, you're adding four levels to your saving throws as both a halfling and a dwarf. So, you know, if you get beyond sixth level or, you know, fourth level for a halfling, you're going to start dealing with some serious power creep there. And then you get into that situation where, you know, the demi-humans, who are not supposed to be as numerous as humans, are now able to outpower the humans. And then you've got, you know, players constantly, well, why would we ever pick a human? You can, you know, get this far. So the limitation is there for a reason, and it's a good reason. And people who rage against that limitation have not read the book and don't understand the rules. So, yeah, and Likely Arrow points this out here. Cleric restriction as an edge weapon came from real-life monks exploiting a loophole in their vows to give up the sword. Yeah, the idea was that a cleric would go into battle, but they were forbidden from drawing blood, so they would use blunt weapons. Also, in Catholic symbology, a mace is representative of power, the same way that, you know, like kings would have maces. The Pope has a mace. Like, if you see the kind of ceremonial garb that the Pope wears, he still carries a mace sometimes. And this was a symbol of authority, of an office. So when you hit someone with a mace as a cleric, you are literally hitting them with the power of God. So take that for what it's worth, which is a lot. Now, let's see. Character alignment, including various monsters and creatures. Before the game begins, it is not only necessary to select a role, but it is also necessary to determine what stance the character will take, law, neutrality, or chaos. Character types are limited as follows by this alignment. So yeah, what you have here is the Michael Moorcock alignments. You don't get into the whole like grid... nine alignments that you have now. You just have three. You've got law, neutrality, and chaos. And so you see that men appear on all three lists, because that's the thing about humans. Humans are diverse. Humans are weird. They cover the entire spectrum, whereas halflings can only be lawful, as you can see here. And the underline and the asterisk, as you can see here, an asterisk indicates that the name appears in both the law and neutrality columns. An underline indicates that the name appears in both the neutrality and chaos columns. So, elves can be lawful or neutral. They cannot be evil. Or lawful or neutral, they cannot be chaotic. Dwarves can be lawful or neutral, not chaotic. I'm surprised that dwarves can even be neutral. Dwarves are generally portrayed as very lawful. Honestly, I'm surprised that a halfling and dwarf are not flipped there. But you can see the kinds of things that are strictly evil. High evil priests, goblins and kobolds, hobgoblins, gnolls. Interestingly enough, orcs can be both neutral and chaotic. But they can't be lawful. Ogres also can be neutral or chaotic. There's lots of interesting things here. Vampires can only be evil or only be chaotic. Mummies are chaotic. Yeah. It's interesting to see this early on kind of what gets to be on multiple lists and what doesn't. And only men and lycanthropes, which again are men, just with the ability to turn into werewolves, they're the only ones that get to be on all three lists. Changing character class. While changing class for other than elves is not recommended, the following rules should be applied. In order for men to change class, they must have a score of 16 or better in the prime requisites, see below, of the class they wish to change to, and the score must be unmodified. A cleric with a strength of 15, for example, could not become a fighting man in any event. Magic users cannot become clerics, and vice versa. All right. Everyone still with me? Yes. Determination of abilities. Prior to the character selection by players, it is necessary for the referee to roll 3 6-sided dice in order to rate each as to various abilities, and thus aid them in selecting a role. Categories of ability are strength, intelligence, wisdom, constitution, dexterity, and charisma. Each player notes its appropriate score, obtains a similar roll of 3 dice to determine the number of gold pieces, dice score times 10, he starts with, and then opts for a roll. A sample of the record of a character appears like this. So, interestingly enough, the players don't roll their own characters. The referee does. So, you sit down at the table with your GM, and your GM rolls your stats for you. In front of you. Although, I guess you could roll behind a screen. But, you know, at my table, I know a lot of old school game masters would actually hide behind full body screens to kind of give that voice of God illusion. But, you know, if you're rolling stats for my character, I want to see the dice. So that's where I kind of go with the crossface stance of no DM screen. Roll everything out in the open. Especially character stats. That's important. And here we have an explanation of abilities. There are no tomatoes mentioned here. So take that for what it's worth. Before we get into that, though, this supposed player would have progressed faster as a cleric, but because of a personal preference for magic, opted for that class. With a strength of only 6, there was no real chance for him to become a fighter. His constitution score indicates good health and the ability to take punishment of most forms. A dexterity of 9, low average, means that he will not be particularly fast nor accurate. He's below average in charisma, but not hopelessly so. So interestingly, this sample character here is a magic user, but not a not an optimized magic user. For the naysayers of early editions who say, you know, if you roll a suboptimal cleric, but you want to play a cleric, it's just impossible. That's not the case at all. Right here, you have a suboptimal magic user with an 11 intelligence, a higher wisdom than intelligence. And as the book says here, he would have progressed faster as a cleric, but the player, personal preference, opted for magic user. So nothing is stopping you, even in this case. Theoretically, you could be a fighter with a strength of 6, but the rules here say it's not a good idea. But just because you roll good cleric stats doesn't necessarily mean that you should play a cleric. Now, my personal preference, seeing a 12 constitution, an 11 intelligence, and a 13 wisdom, I'm playing a cleric. even this early on, you can see that the rules say, you know, pick what you want to play. You don't have to pick a cleric just because you rolled good cleric stats. Now, explanation of abilities. The first three categories are the prime requisite for each of the three classes, fighting men, magic users, and clerics. See bonuses and penalties to advancement due to abilities table, which appears hereafter. Strength is the prime requisite for fighters. Clerics can use strength for on a 3-for-1 basis in their prime requisite area, wisdom, for the purpose of gaining experience only. Strength will also aid in opening traps and so on. Intelligence is the prime requisite for magical types. Both fighters and clerics can use it in their prime requisite areas, strength and wisdom, respectively, on a 2-for-1 basis. Intelligence will also affect referees' decisions as to whether or not certain actions would be taken, and it allows additional languages to be spoken. Wisdom is the prime requisite for clerics. It may be used on a 3-for-1 basis by fighters and on a 2-for-1 basis by magic users in their respective prime requisite areas. Wisdom rating will act much as does that for intelligence. Constitution is a combination of health and endurance. It will influence such things as the numbers of hits which can be taken and how well the character can withstand being paralyzed, turned to stone, etc. Dexterity applies to both manual speed and conjuration. It will indicate the character's missile ability and speed with actions such as firing first, getting off a spell, etc. Charisma is a combination of appearance, personality, and so forth. Its primary function is to determine how many hirelings of unusual nature a character can attract. This is not to say that he cannot hire men-at-arms and employ mercenaries, but the charisma function will affect the loyalty of these men. Players will, in all probability, seek to hire fighting men, magic users, and/or clerics in order to strengthen their roles in the campaign. A player character can employ as many as indicated by his charisma score. So, this presupposes that you will hire out mercenaries, which, again, is interesting. This is one of the major areas which modern D&D splits off of its predecessor. It assumes, as you've heard the arguments over and over again, that you will be using hirelings, and charisma is the primary mechanic that determines how many hirelings you can use. So, charisma score of 3-4, you can only hire one hireling, and he's got a -2 loyalty base. So when he makes those morale checks, -2. 5-6, 2 hirelings and a -1. 7-9, 3 hirelings with no bonus or penalty to loyalty base. 10-12, 4 hirelings, same, no bonus, no penalty. 13-15, you can have 5 hirelings, the +1 loyalty base. 16-17, 6 hirelings, +2. And 18, you can have a maximum of 12 hirelings. So you notice between 17 and 18, the number doubles. That's how rare, you know, rolling 3d6 in order in 18 would be for charisma. Charisma is the last score you roll. So, hey, you roll an 18 in charisma, congratulations. You can hire 12 hirelings with a loyalty base of +4 because you're that awesome. In addition, the charisma score is usable to decide such things as whether or not a witch capturing a player will turn him into a swine or keep him enchanted as a lover. Oh, man, having a high charisma score might doom you to being mind-controlled by an ugly hag into being her lover. So, you know, it's not always easy being pretty, shall we say. And then finally, charisma will aid a character in attracting various monsters to his service. So you will notice there's a distinct lack of charisma being used as some kind of social mechanic for whether or not you can lie to someone. the primary function of charisma here is hirelings. Like that's what this is all about, is how many people can you hire to be part of your party? That was the assumed use of charisma, not am I going to be able to convince the dragon to sleep with me, which is really interesting. And now bonuses and penalties to advancement due to abilities. Low score is 3 to 8, average is 9 to 12, and high is 13 to 18. So, if your prime requisite, so this is the prime requisite for your, the stat that you need most for your character class. So, you know, strength for your fighter. If it's 15 or more, you can add 10% to earned experience. If your prime requisite is 13 to 14, you can add 5% to earned experience. So let's go back up here to our sample character. When Gary says that he would level faster as a cleric, you'll notice that the wisdom here is 13. So per these rules down here, he'd be able to add 5% to his earned experience. But because this player wants to play a magic user, he doesn't add any bonus. So yes, he would actually, it's not even referring to survivability necessarily. You literally get more experience if you are better suited for the role that you're playing. So there's an incentive to pick a class that goes along with your stats. You're not, well, I guess down here, you are penalized in a way. Like if that player wanted to be a fighter with a 6 strength, minus 20% from earned experience. So yeah, there is a little bit of a penalty associated. And then, yeah, if you have a 8 or a 7 in your prime requisite, minus 10% from earned experience, minus 20% for 6 or less. Constitution of 15 or more for any class, add plus 1 to each hit die. 13 to 14 will withstand adversity. Constitution of 9 to 12, 60 to 90% chance of survival. Constitution of 8 or 7, 40 to 50 chance, 50% chance of survival. And a constitution of 6 or less, minus 1 from each hit die. So that's your Elric of Melnibone here with your 6 or less constitution. And it does have a minimum score of 1 on any die. So if you roll a 1, 1 hit point. And dexterity above 12, fire any missile at plus 1. Dexterity under 9, fire any missile at minus 1. Note the average scores are 9 to 12 units, so indicated above may be used to increase prime requisite total insofar as this does not bring the category below average, i.e. below a score of 9. Yep. All right. Likely arrow. If I play a Pentecostal cleric, shouldn't charisma be my PR? Yes. Yes, it should be. And languages. The common tongue is spoken throughout the continent. It is known by most humans. All other creatures and monsters which can speak have their own language, although some, 20%, also know the common one. Interesting. Only 20% of other, basically non-humans, know the common tongue. So 80% of the elves you run into have no idea what you're saying. 80% of the dwarves couldn't care less. You might as well be speaking gibberish to them. Only 20% will understand you. Law, chaos, and neutrality also have common languages spoken by each respectively. One can attempt to communicate through the common tongue, language particular to a creature class, or one of the divisional languages, law, etc. While not understanding the language, creatures who speak a divisional tongue will recognize a hostile one and attack. Characters with an intelligence above 10 may learn additional languages. one language. Yeah, one language for every point above 10 intelligence factors. Thus, a man with an intelligence level of 15 could speak seven languages, i.e. the common tongue, his divisional language, and five creature languages. Of course, magic user spells and some magic items will enable the speaking and understanding of languages. So yeah, here is the mention of alignment languages, which is an idea that is no longer with modern editions of D&D. Still, it's kind of a cool mechanic, and a lot of people have done a lot to defend it, because some people don't understand it. Some people wonder, you know, what do you mean you speak lawful? But it's this idea of kind of a jargon that comes with a certain belief system. Anytime you talk to someone of a different religion than you about their religion, you will encounter something like that. That's almost what you're dealing with here. It's this this jargon associated with kind of your worldview. Now, non-player characters. In all probability, the referee will find it beneficial to allow participants in the campaign to hire into service one or more characters. At times, this may be nothing more than a band of mercenaries hired to participate in and share the profits from some adventure. However, it is likely that players will be desirous of acquiring a regular entourage of various character types, monsters, and an army of some form. Non-player characters can be hired as follows. So again, page 12 of the first player's handbook is all about hiring mercenaries. So yeah, there you go. Checkmate. All of you out there, Scythian, who have argued with me about D&D characters not being allowed to hire hirelings. That's just stupid and nonsensical. It's here from the beginning. Only the lowest level of character types can be hired. The player wishing to hire a non-player character advertises by posting notices at inns and taverns, frequents public places seeking the desired hirelings, or sends messengers to whatever place the desired character type would be found, Elfland, Dwarfland, etc. This costs money and takes time, and the referee must determine expenditure. Once some response has been obtained, the player must make an offer to tempt the desired character type into his service. As a rule of thumb, a minimum offer of 100 gold pieces would be required to tempt a human into service. Dwarves are more interested in gold, magic users and elves desire magic items, and clerics want some assurance of having a place of worship in which to house themselves. 100 gold pieces. 100 gold pieces for a first level fighter. Seems reasonable. Monsters can be lured into service if they are of the same basic alignment as the player character, or they may be charmed and thus ordered to serve. Note, however, that the term monster includes men found in the dungeons, so in this way, some high-level characters can be brought into a character's service. Charisma, allowing or through a charm spell. Some rewards must be offered to a monster in order to induce it into service, not just sparing its life, for example. The monster will react with appropriate pluses or minuses according to the offer, the referee rolling 2 6-sided dices and adjusting for charisma. So here we have the infamous reaction rolls. So a dice score of 2, attempts to attack, 3 to 5, hostile reaction, 6 to 8, uncertain, 9 to 11, accepts offer, 12, enthusiastic loyalty, +3. So that would be to your morale checks. An uncertain reaction leaves the door open to additional reward offers, but a score under 6 does not. So basically, 2 through 5, this thing is not going to work with you no matter what you offer it. 6 or above, you've got some wiggle room to work with here. You've got some negotiating power. All All right, we're going to do this one more page here, and then we're probably going to have to call it for the night. What if Darth Vader rolls a 12 on a reaction? Then Darth Vader really wants to hang out with your party, I guess. And Crossface points out an example here where Huygma spoke lawful to a Medusa in disguise in his game. And because he spoke lawful to her, it caused her to lash out because a Medusa is chaotic. So that's the kind of thing you can do with alignment languages. That's the power of speaking lawful good. So, capture of non-player monsters. Morale dice can cause a man or intelligent monster to attempt to surrender or become subdued. When this happens, an offer of service can be made, assuming that communication is possible, as outlined above. Subdued monsters will obey for a time without need to check their reactions, and such monsters are saleable. See Volume 2. Loyalty of non-player characters, including monsters. Men, dwarves, and elves will serve as retainers with relative loyalty so long as they receive their pay regularly, are treated fairly, are not continually exposed to extra hazardous duty, and receive bonuses when they are taking part in some dangerous venture. Gotta hazard pay your employees. You can't just use them as meat shields, otherwise they won't want to work with you. Judgment of this matter is perforce subjective on the part of the campaign referee. But there is a simple guideline. When one or more of such characters are taken into service, a loyalty check is made by rolling 3 6-sided dice. Adjustments are made for charisma and initial payments for service. And the loyalty of the characters noted by the referee. The players will not have any knowledge of what it is without some method of reading minds. Okay, so this is all done, again, by the referee. So this happens behind the screen, as it were. But loyalty score, 3 or less on the dice will desert at first opportunity. 4 to 6, -2 on morale dice. 7 through 8, -1 on morale dice. 9 through 12, average morale dice. 13 to 14, +1 on morale dice. 15 to 18, +2 on morale dice. 19 and above, need never check morale. So, morale is something that you'll see in Volume 2 with each monster. It's also something that you would see in chainmail from particular units. So when it refers to morale dice, that's what this is talking about. Although most of you watching this already know that. Non-player characters and men-at-arms will have to make morale checks using the above reaction table or chainmail. Whenever a highly dangerous or unnerving situation arises, poor morale will mean that those in question will not perform as expected. Periodic rechecks of loyalty should be made. Length of service, rewards, etc. will bring additional pluses. Poor treatment will bring minuses. So, theoretically, let's say you continuously get good morale rolls out of your... out of your retainers, you could end up with, massive bonuses to morale, or you could get to the point where you never have to check morale again because you rolled a 19. Of course, with that, you would need an 18 on the dice or at least something pretty high on the dice, and then a decent charisma. Now, relatives. The referee may allow players to designate one relative of his character to inherit his possessions if, for any reason, the participant unexpectedly disappears with or without death being positively established for a period of 1 game month, let us say. At this time, the relative would inherit the estate of the character, paying a 10% tax on all goods and monies. The relative must start at the lowest level of class he opts for, but he will have the advantage of the inheritance. So, your fighter goes missing, and then that's where your fighter's cousin comes in as a first level fighter. Even though your fighter was seventh level, he comes in at first level, but he's got your castle now. So he's got that going for him, which is nice. If the character returns, he takes possession of his estates once more. Referee's option as to willingness of the relative to give it up, but must pay an additional 10% tax in order to regain his own. Optionally, the relative may be allowed to stay on as a non-player character in the service of the player character. Loyalty of the relative in such a circumstance would be at a penalty from 0 to minus 6, and he would possibly intrigue to regain control. Characters without a relative will lose all of their possessions should they disappear and not return before whatever period is designated as establishing death. So, if you stay in the dungeon for too long or you get lost in the wilderness, you come back and your brother's taken over your fortress. All your men are now like answering to your brother. And suddenly you've got a situation on your hands. And per the rules here, that could cause you a headache, to say the very least. And okay, the next thing is equipment. So we can do that real quick and then we'll have to call it. Basic equipment and cost. It will be necessary for players to equip their characters with various basic items of equipment. Selections of items is strictly up to the players, and gold pieces are taken away accordingly. Players may sell to one another, of course, and then gold pieces would be transferred. So, if you remember correctly, at the beginning, you are rolling 3d6 times 10 for your starting gold. So, if I can grab 3d6 here real quick. Let's say I'm rolling up a fighter to start with. Okay, I rolled a 6. That's a 4 and 2 ones. So I would have 60 gold pieces to start with. So with my 60 gold pieces as a fighter, I could buy chainmail and I could buy a two-handed sword. Or I could buy just a regular sword, and then that would leave, let's see, what's a shield cost? Shield costs 10 gold pieces. So yeah, I could buy a regular sword and a shield and chainmail, and that would actually leave me with 10 gold left over. So I could, you know, buy some more items there. You can also, as pointed out by Mr. Wargaming John Mollison, kind of cheap out on your own gear, maybe not fully equip yourself the most that you possibly could afford and buy some men-at-arms to adventure with you early on. Although he was doing that in AD&D first edition. So it might be different here, depending on your charisma score. But yeah, you see a lot of the same stuff that you see in modern equipment lists. You've got your 50 feet of rope, your 10-foot pole. There it is. First appearance of the 10-foot pole. Iron spikes, large sack, small sack, flask of oil. Interestingly enough, the only armor that you're able to get is leather armor, chain type, plate mail, a helmet, and a shield. So you don't have the like full breakdown of different types of armor that you can get. And there's also, you know, the only people who can use armor at this point are fighters and clerics and elves and dwarves. So, you know, the need for light, medium, and heavy armor, it's not really a thing in this edition necessarily. Because, you know, there's no thieves, there's no rangers. You know, if you wear armor, you're a fighting man or a cleric, and that's about it. So you've got three different types of armor, at three different price points, and then some accessories that can add to your armor class. So we are 17 pages into the white box. At some point, we will... Am I back? Let's see. Yeah, at some point we will come back to we'll come back to reading these rules, because I do want to go through this and get a good understanding of white box, especially I've got a lot of friends who are really getting into white box. Crossface is one of them. Victor Gorchev is making Ammo Box, which is a white box modern, which will be really interesting. Mako Heetel is based on white box. So yeah, there's lots of cool stuff. Coming around this first edition of D&D. So we're definitely going to come back to this at some point. Whenever I don't have a guest, we will continue our reading of white box D&D. Next week, I am hoping to have Greg Gillespie on for a conversation about how to use Scottish folklore and Scottish history in adventuring. I'm really looking forward to that. That's going to be the first of multiple episodes where we focus in on specific eras of history, specific regions of the world and their folklore, and how you can use them to influence your D&D campaigns. So I'm hoping to kick that off next week with Greg Gillespie. But until then, whether you rolled a 1 or a 20, I'm so glad that you rolled your bones with me, Ryan Howard, and I will see you guys next time. Have a good night.